shut off their cell phones. I do not allow cell phones to be on in court. Secondly, I will allow all attorneys to use laptops, and anyone who is in the gallery may use their laptop as well. However, if you are here in the gallery, you can only use it to take notes. You cannot use it to communicate with anybody outside the courtroom, nor can you use it to record in any fashion. The court has allowed, pursuant to South Dakota Statute 16-20-1 and in subsequent statutes, audio recording of this proceeding by Sioux City television station KTIV. They are the only media outlet that is authorized to record this proceeding. They are only allowed to do so on audio and not with video. And if anyone wants any audio recording of these proceedings, they will need to coordinate that with KTIV. This is a public proceeding, and the public has a right to be present. However, we also have a posted capacity of 70 persons. I believe at this point in time, I haven't done the head counts, but I believe we're okay. But if more people come in, I may need to address that issue so that we do not violate the fire code regulations. If so, obviously all members of the all parties and their counsel will be allowed to remain. And any members of the public who are here, we will draw lots to see who will be allowed to remain. But again, at this point in time, I believe we are satisfactory as to that. So at this time, we are going to go on the record in this case. But the record show that it is 1:05 p.m. on Tuesday, December 17, 2013. This is the time and place set for hearing in Union County, Civil File 12-292, entitled Beef Products Incorporated, BPI Technology Incorporated, and Freezing Machines Incorporated Plaintiffs versus American Broadcasting Companies Incorporated, ABC News Incorporated, Diane Sawyer, Jim Avila, David Curley, Gerald Steen, Carl Custer, and Kit Foshi defendants. I would ask at this time that counsel please note their appearances for the record. I would also ask that when you stand up for your specific arguments, that you please identify yourself again for the record. So let's start with plaintiff's counsel, please.
Eric Conley on behalf of the plaintiffs. Senator Dan Webb on behalf of the plaintiffs.
Your Honor, Nicole Brady on behalf of the plaintiffs.
Your Honor, Terry Grimm on behalf of the plaintiffs.
Your Honor, Matthew Barnes on behalf of the plaintiffs.
Your Honor, Dan Hartman on behalf of the plaintiff.
Your Honor, Vince Roach on behalf of the defendants, Custer and Jersey.
Your Honor,
Shane Bailey
on behalf of the ABC defendants.
Your Honor, William Arler on behalf of the defendants, Jersey and Custer.
I think I take Your Honor's ruling as a direction that I should not refer to the patent application.
Correct.
So let me not refer to the patent application. Let me show what the broadcast shows. A picture of process, beginning with these graphs that are mostly fat, which BPI tells us contain so much fat that it's impossible to separate it with a knife. It sends it through this process of heat tempering, centrifuging, and then the product is spread out on a steel drum, and you can see in the middle slide, these are three screenshots from the March 29th broadcast when BPI allowed ABC into their plant to actually film the process. And this is what the product looks like. It's spread out on this 14-foot drum. Now, you can't do that with steak. You can't do that with hamburger meat. That is a clearly a consistency that's fairly called slimy.
Mr. Bain, I'm going to stop you there because as I look at, again, I realize this is a motion to dismiss and you're referring only to exhibits that are attached to the plaintiff's complaint, but when we start talking about whether a statement is true or not true, that to me seems to cross over into that unique line of the court judging the facts and knowing all of the facts regarding the process, not just a few pictures or not just a few things, but that to me would seem uniquely discussion that's more appropriate for summary judgment stage than it is for a motion.
Fair enough. Then let me emphasize this point because I know that my time is running short. I understand why the plaintiff doesn't like the term pink slime. But the argument here is not over...
You may continue.
Thank you. It's not over an objectively false statement. The argument is about the image that's created by a name. The plaintiff calls this product lean, finely textured beef. That sounds even better than ground beef. BPI's experimented with lots of other names to try to convey a positive image. And then a critic comes along and calls it pink slime, which conveys a negative image. Let's face it, lean, finely textured beef is a euphemism for high fat trimmings that are heat tempered, centrifuged, and ammoniated. It's a euphemism. And pink slime is an epithet. And our point is simply this. The defendants had as much right to use the epithet pink slime as the producer has to use the euphemism lean, finely textured beef.
And what is that based upon? Is it based upon the assertion that it's simply an opinion?
Yes, it is a rhetorical, hyperbolic expression that does not convey any factual content at all that is alleged to be false.
And the South Dakota Supreme Court has recognized in the paintbrush case that opinion does not insulate statement from the defamation claims. So how do you distinguish paintbrush?
The paintbrush case says that calling an opinion is not the end of the analysis. The question is, and it's a legal question for the court, whether the statement or the expression, your pink slime, can reasonably be understood to convey facts that are alleged to be false. And our position is that the term pink slime cannot reasonably be understood as anything other than an expression of disapproval and cannot be understood as an assertion of fact that is untrue.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Plaintiff's counsel.
Can I remove the...
Yes.
And the one point of clarification, when you were indicating the exhibits that would and would not consider, I think you said Exhibit A to ABC's motion to dismiss, which is the agricultural food product statement. Is that out or that in?
That is out. The Exhibit A is the motion... Exhibit to ABC's motion to dismiss the claims of BPI, Tech, and Freezing Machines.
Perfect. Thank you.
Good morning, Eric on behalf of plaintiffs. The First Amendment does not protect what these defendants did. These defendants engaged in a prolonged and extensive disinformation campaign. They published 190 false statements. They knew their statements were factually inaccurate. They knew their statements were causing a consumer backlash based on false information. And then, with that knowledge, they continued to repeat the false statements day after day.
When you referenced the number of 190, I believe in your brief you said close to ballpark. Are you contending that they said 190 different defamatory alleged new statements, or that they may have repeated some of the same statements in different occasions?
They did repeat some of the false statements on different occasions. Appendix 1 to our complaint lists out a whole 190, and there are subtle variations in the different false statements that they made. And in that appendix, we try to highlight for the court parts of the appendix or part of the statements that were the particularly defamatory and false statements that they made. So what we have here is a defendant, a group of defendants, who knew that they were creating a consumer backlash based on false information and continued the pattern and practice. The objective was to damage BPI's reputation and destroy its relationship with its customers. And they succeeded. Now,
in most of the, most of the statements that I've seen in reviewing the complaints and the attachments to the complaint, there's rarely a reference to BPI specifically. Would you agree?
Yes and no. I think a lot of the statements in isolation may not have been a specific reference to BPI. However, BPI is the only producer of LFTB that they had ever referenced in any of their coverage. BPI is the only one that was discussed in their coverage. BPI is 70% of the market for lean, finely textured beef. BPI is the company that went through the USDA approval that they lied about. BPI has the process and is the only one with the process that they talked about. This was about BPI. And everybody understood it to be BPI. If you look at the consumer reactions, the company that the consumers are reacting negatively to as a result of the statements, BPI, no one else. I understand that there's a disagreement regarding the events that took place, but the allegations of our complaint are accepted as true for the purposes of this motion to dismiss. And we are at a notice plea. We need to state a plausible claim. And if a 200-page, 700-paragraph complaint with 60 exhibits that details piece by piece the false statements, the reasons that they are false, the false implications, the reasons that they were false, as well as the consumer reaction, if that doesn't satisfy notice pleading and a plausible cause of action, I'm not sure what would. And Your Honor hit a very important point during the last argument. ABC has not cited a single case where a South Dakota court granted a motion to dismiss a defamation or disparagement case. Not a single one. We've had a lot of briefing on this. Now, this is not the case where the court should be setting new precedent in favor of the defendants. These are disputed issues of fact that should go through discovery and then go to a jury ultimately. I'm going to try to cut for several of the points that they put forward in their reply briefs and their opening briefs, and also touch upon some things that counsel brought up. But let me start with defamation, because I think what you will see with defamation is a theme that is true with the vast majority of the arguments that ABC has presented. ABC's arguments are either inconsistent with South Dakota law, or they are unprecedented under South Dakota law. So let's start with defamation. ABC contends that we cannot state a defamation claim because many of the statements are about the product, lean, finely textured beef. They say no South Dakota case can hold that. And in truth, the South Dakota Supreme Court has repeatedly allowed defamation claims based upon false statements about a product. Youngquist, Your Honor, involved a false statement about the health of a plaintiff's horse, and that was considered defamation by the South Dakota Supreme Court. Paintbrush was about the quality of a party's paintbrushes, and that allowed a defamation claim. Ramharder was one article about the quality of the plaintiff's stoves, and that was allowed as a defamation claim. If those cases, which involve publication of one article, one false statement,
you asserting then that a defamation claim, you acknowledge that there is an overlap then between the disparagement claims that have been asserted and the defamation claims?
Yes.
And so are you asserting that plaintiff can proceed under both as alternatives or that they can recover under both?
No, I cannot recover under both. I can proceed and I can allow a jury to get a charge on both. That is my absolute right. But no, I cannot get double recovery. I cannot get double recovery. So, to crystallize the defamation, you need to remember that we have a company that its reputation was that as a producer of a safe, nutritious beef product, an award-winning one. BPI comes along, or ABC comes along, describes them as the maker of King Slime. They describe it as a company that is producing a filler that's not really meat and not what it purports to be, meat. They describe it as a company that is using waste and scraps to make a product. And they describe it as a company that only got approval for this product because a USDA official with ties to the beef industry overruled scientists. Every one of those statements is factually inaccurate. But ABC used those statements to destroy BPI's reputation, and that gives BPI a defamation case under Dr. Civil Law.
But what about what Mr. Bain was referencing when they were pointing out that it was safe?
I can go straight to that one if you would like me to.
Please.
Absolutely.
This is ABC's negation argument.
What ABC is trying to say is, listen, we tried to present, and we did present, some accurate information. We gave some both sides of the conversation. And since we did that, Your Honor, no reasonable juror could possibly come to the conclusion that we created a false implication. ABC has tried that exact same argument before. They tried that exact same argument in Lundell versus ABC. They tried that exact same argument in Weller versus ABC. In both of those cases, what ABC's defense was telling the court no reasonable juror could possibly come to the conclusion that it's being alleged by the plaintiff because we provided some other information. We provided some accurate information. In both those cases, the court absolutely rejected the argument. The case went to the jury, and the jury found for the plaintiff. And the reason that argument fails is because you look at the totality of the publications and the gist and the sting of the publications. And only if the court makes the determination that no juror could reasonably conclude that they implied that the product was not safe for us, can you take the case away from the jury. Otherwise, it's a jury issue. That's what Paintbrush tells us. Paintbrush is very clear that the preference here in South Dakota is that those go to the jury, and we have seen no South Dakota case where it doesn't. It gets dismissed by a court at this stage of the litigation. So let's talk about this. This is an excellent example, actually, of what ABC was doing and how they were counteracting any accurate information that they were providing. Let's go through their diagram. They say you start off with cow, and it goes into ABC describes this meat as scraps, as waste, as the parts of the most contaminated parts of the cow. So that's, they show this picture, but that's how they describe what's going on right here. Then we get to the next stage, and Mr. Bain describes it as tempering. ABC, during their broadcast, say, hey, look, fire. This is where BPI cooks the product, and they simmer the product. We absolutely do not cook the product. We absolutely do not simmer the product. That actually would be adding cooked meat to fresh ground meat. And that's a real safety issue. So they falsely describe what went on at this stage. Then you get to the centrifuge. What did ABC say about that? The centrifuge is where you concentrate the harmful bacteria. That's what they said. So now we've got the centrifuge process. Concentrating the harmful bacteria. Absolutely false. Not true. Then you go down here and you have a picture of ammonia hydroxide being used. How did ABC describe that? Sprayed, disinfected, as if we put in this large volume of ammonia into our product. We use parts per million, a minuscule amount, to raise the ammonia level that already exists in ground beef. All beef has it. But they decided to call our product spraying, disinfecting, and treating. That's how they call this stage. Then we get to the end product. How did ABC describe that? Pink slime. Not once, 132 times they described it as pink slime. So while this picture is a good picture, and Mr. Bain can say this demonstrates that we told the product was safe, a reasonable juror could come to a different conclusion based upon the context. Same problem. Look at this. This is great. They put up a picture that says, USDA, pink slime is safe. Okay, their version of that is going to be, that's us giving a safety endorsement to it. But what else did they say about the USDA? USDA officials with ties to the beef industry overruled their scientists to allow pink slime out of the marketplace. So you show a USDA endorsement on the one hand, and you make the USDA seem like an uncredible source on the other. How in the world, then, does this become an unequivocal safety endorsement such that no reasonable juror could possibly reach a contrary conclusion? Where, in the same breath, you show the USDA, you criticize the USDA as being an unworthy source. Same problem exists when they talk about the beef industry saying it's safe, or they say BPI says it's safe. At the same time they make those statements, they're saying that BPI and the beef industry are engaged in economic fraud, a food fraud, by hiding this product in ground beef. It's lurking in the ground beef.
Let's talk about the First Amendment implications of this, because as I stated in talking with Mr. Bain, that it would appear to the court that a news organization would want to be presenting both sides. And so if then that news organization is going to be subject to liability by presenting the negative side, isn't that going to quash or at least make those news organizations hesitant to bring forth any criticism?
No, absolutely. Bring out negative information. Bring out the opposing view. Don't stifle debate. But the statements that you make have to be factually accurate. And the moment that you tread over from just doing debate with facts into debates with inaccurate, let me change that, knowingly inaccurate information, you are no longer in the purview of the First Amendment, and that's not the type of debate that the First Amendment protects. If ABC simply provided factually accurate information, that would be fine, but that's not what ABC did. The complaint clearly identifies that the information that they provided was factually inaccurate, but not only that, that they knew it was factually inaccurate. There has not been another case where at a motion to dismiss statement, at this pleading stage, there has been so much evidence that the defendant acted with actual malice. Volumes of information was provided to them, so they knew what they were saying was absolutely false. That's not the kind of debate that's protected by the First Amendment. Never. It has never been. So, on the safety issue as well, this isn't just a case where maybe one statement maybe sort of implied that it wasn't safe. The complaint identifies 151 different statements that they made implying our product was not safe. The complaint also explains how the overall tone and tenor of their publications implied our product wasn't safe. Lurking, a startling investigation, something lurking in your ground beef. It's hidden in your ground beef. These are a bunch of people in the beef industry who won't eat the product anymore. It's pink slime. It's an adulterant. And sure, Mr. Bain has a, you know, an interpretation of adulterant that he thinks is fine. We have an interpretation of adulterant that means it's a poisonous substance. And you know who decides? The jury. The jury will decide which interpretation is correct. So there is 151 different statements in this complaint implying the product was not safe. And I'm not aware of any case where that volume has been presented in a complaint before. And to conclude that no reasonable juror could possibly conclude that the product isn't safe based on what they said is inconsistent with the volume of information put forward in the complaint report.
And you may be going there next, but Mr. Bain had characterized the allegations in the complaint as involving assertions that the product was not safe, not nutritious, and not meat or beef. Do you agree that the allegations are divided in that way, or are you believing they're all asserting the product was not safe?
No. I think he's right and wrong. The complaint is divided into several parts. We have 8 false statement claims, which fall into 9 general categories. For each of those false statement claims, the statements that were made in and of themselves were factually inaccurate and knowingly factually inaccurate. So the court can sustain the false statement claim simply based on the precise language they used and the factual inaccuracy of that. The court can also sustain the false statement claims because those false statements implied additional false facts about the product. So for example, when you say you have a count, the trimmings used by BPI were once only used for dog food, is what ABC says, okay? That's factually inaccurate. That's just not true. ABC knew that wasn't true, but they broadcast it. Because that is factually inaccurate, that standing alone provides a cause of action. But by making that declaration, that statement, in combination with the rest, also is implying our product isn't safe. So we can sustain the false statement claims on either basis. And the false implication claims, there are 8 of them. There's the false implication that our product is not beef, the false implication that our product is not safe, the false implication that our product has little to no nutritional value, and the false implication that BPI engaged in improper conduct. Those counts take a look at the totality of their publications, everything that they were saying, and everything that they were saying feeds into those implications. And what we did in the complaint, Your Honor, to try to make this clear, is that in each implication claim, we identify the different categories of false statements that lead to that implication. So for example, if you look at if they implied it wasn't beef, we set forth a variety of types of statements that they made and referenced them as saying, this is how they implied it wasn't beef. They called it pink slime. They have statements where they said it wasn't beef. They called it a filler. They called it a substitute. They said selling it was akin to economic fraud. All of those categories of false statements created that false implication. And the only way those implication claims go away is that the court reaches the conclusion that as a matter of law, no reasonable juror could conclude that false implication is made. And we've seen no South Dakota law, or show no South Dakota decision where a court made that determination at the motion to dismiss. The other issue, I'm sorry, did you have a?
Well,
you did.
And you may be leading to that, but you've identified, as I would understand, groupings into what I would call 4 categories: not beef, not nutritious, not safe, improper conduct by BPI. And as I would understand the briefs submitted by the ABC defendants, they are asserting that defamation claims are traditionally claims involving the reputation of a person or entity, whereas disparagement claims involve a product. And I recognize what you've said before, that you believe in South Dakota, defamation claims have been allowed on behalf of the company, even though it involves a product.
Yeah.
That leads me to the preemption issue of South Dakota Chapter 20-10A.
Okay.
And so I'd like you to take that issue on.
I'll do preemption right now. This argument is inconsistent with South Dakota law, and it is unprecedented under South Dakota law. Step back and think about what ABC is arguing. ABC is contending that every industry in this state, everyone in this state, can assert common law product disparagement claims, except for one, that the South Dakota legislature decided that they wanted to take away the common law right of the agricultural industry in this state, that that's what they intended to do. And I suggest that that argument has no basis in South Dakota law or the facts involved with the AFPDA.
What about Burnett versus Myers? That was the South Dakota Supreme Court case cited in Home.
Yep.
There's a case in which a cause of action would be stated for trespass if a farmer's animals got onto your property and destroyed something. And the South Dakota Supreme Court in Burnett back in 1919 said the statutory-based remedy precludes any common law.
I'm glad you brought up Burnett. Burnett's a great example. In Burnett, the South Dakota legislature put together a comprehensive remedial scheme. Burnett involved 33 different paragraphs about animal trespass. Burnett addresses every single situation that could come up involving animal trespass, and it went into exhaustive detail about each leg of what would happen and how a plaintiff can protect themselves under those circumstances, and addressed all the circumstances where a common law remedy existed. Burnett is an excellent example of how the South Dakota legislature can preempt a common law. Compare that to the AFPDA. 237 words long. It addresses one situation only. The legislature made no attempt to go into a exhaustive and detailed remedial scheme to cover all circumstances that previously existed under common law. And that's actually a critical point that I'm going to go through in just one second. Actually, I'll do it now. That's a critical issue. The South Dakota Supreme Court has recognized that if there is a wrongdoing that has for which there is a remedy under the common law, and a statute doesn't provide a way for a plaintiff to seek redress when that wrongdoing happens, they will not find preemption. The Brackmuller case is a very good example of where that happens. In Brackmuller, the plaintiff wanted to challenge a wrongful conviction after he got out of prison, and the common law allowed him to do that. There had been enacted a statute that says this is how you challenge a wrongful conviction while you're in prison. When the argument of preemption came up, the court said, no, we're not finding preemption here. There is a wrongdoing that the statute doesn't provide any remedy for. We're going to allow him to use his common law rights. The court did the exact same thing in Jones. In the Jones case, the plaintiff wanted to challenge the manner in which the entire jury pool had been selected, and which he was allowed to do under the common law. The statute provided him a means of challenging individual jurors. And the court said, we're absolutely going to allow him to assert his common law remedy. The statute doesn't give him a way of doing it.
Why should I rely on criminal cases in a civil case? Because I believe in criminal cases, the court's always going to err on the side of a criminal defendant because their liberty is at issue. And so why should I look to those cases when this is a civil case?
One, I have not seen the South Dakota Supreme Court indicate in those opinions that its analysis of the preemption issue varies criminal versus civil. And In re Brackmuller was not a criminal case, it was civil. So if you look at the scope of the Agricultural Food Product Disparagement Act, in light of those cases, what you see is it addresses a way of getting redress for one situation. Safety is at issue, done knowingly. The common law provides a remedy under product disparagement for a far, far broader range of action. If we follow Brackmuller and Jones, we cannot preempt the common law right. But that's not the only reason there's no preemption here. Look at the express language of the statute. The South Dakota legislature knows how to preempt something when that's what it wants to do. And the court explained this very, very clearly in the Youngquist case. So in Youngquist, the issue was a statute had been passed that said if you are an unregistered partnership, you cannot assert common law claims. I'm sorry, you cannot assert contract claims. The defendant in Youngquist tried to say, well, that preempts tort claims as well. And the Supreme Court said, no. The Supreme Court said, our legislature, if that had been their intent, would have unmistakably said so. Apply that to this case. There's not a word in this statute that suggests any intent to preempt common law claims.
That wasn't in Burnett, either.
But Burnett is a comprehensive remedial scheme statute.
What about Home?
Home is a duty case. So Home has a very interesting history to it. So in Home, what happened is the plaintiff wanted to bring a cause of action based upon guardrails. And in 1905, I believe it was, the South Dakota legislature passed its first piece of legislation about guardrails. And what were the circumstances under which a municipality could be held liable for guardrails? Then in 1917, if I got the date right, could have been 1919, the South Dakota legislature changed that statute. And it broadened the circumstances under which there would be a duty, so to support a negligence claim, for not erecting guardrails. And then in, I think it was 1936, the South Dakota legislature once again revised that statute. And this time they narrowed the scope to a very limited set of circumstances. Now, there was no common law remedy for the individual, because the municipalities never had a common law obligation to maintain guardrails. It was all statutory creation. And what the court said, when you look through how detailed and how much attention the legislature had placed to create, then to expand, then to contract, the court said, we're not going to expand that statutory duty, because it's a duty case, beyond what's said in the statute.
So you agree that the statute, Chapter 20-10A, talks about safety.
Yes.
So to the extent then that your claims involve your defamation and disparagement, common law claims involve safety. Are you agreeing that those are preempted?
No.
Or you're asserting them in the alternative?
They are not preempted. And the reason they are not preempted is that they exist as a common law remedy. Again, you need to go back to see whether or not the statute clearly manifested an intent to preempt those. And we have in the statute, to pursue our claim, we have to establish a knowing violation. Under the common law for my safety claim, I can satisfy it with reckless disregard. So I have different elements for my common law product disparagement claim about safety, and a different element that I would have to satisfy my statutory.
So ultimately, are you asserting that you can recover under both?
I can get a charge to the jury, which will allow me to recover actual damages one time. And if the jury finds an intent to harm, I can recover treble damages under the statute, which I cannot do under the common law. And that actually is very important. So to answer your question completely and fully, the jury will get charged with both cases. And the jury can award me actual loss, actual damages under both the common law and potentially under the statutory law. What I can get under the statutory remedy, and only the statutory remedy, is the additional treble damages if I meet my burden of proof on that. So I don't get double recovery for that. But that actually, that question brings up a very important observation about this statute as well. This statute does provide the vehicle for treble damages, which is not a remedy available under the common law. And courts outside of South Dakota have wrestled with this issue of what do you do when a statute provides you additional recovery that's not available for the town of law. And unanimously, the courts have held that that does not preempt the common law.
But what about SDCL 20-10A-2, which specifically says any producer, and I'm going to eliminate the middle part, but any producer has a cause of action for damages and any other appropriate relief in a court of competent jurisdiction. So in that statute, the South Dakota legislature has said you have a right as a producer to damages and any other appropriate relief. So they've provided for all of the damages, they're all the relief. And then they've added to it trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So doesn't that present a different situation?
No, not at all. All I got would be AFPDA is a statutory cause of action. There's nothing unique about creating a statutory cause of action. In the state, people bring statutory causes of actions under negligence, under the statutes governing negligence, but then also bring a common law negligence claim.
Well, but let's talk about defamation. Under South Dakota law, defamation is defined by statute, and so it's a statutory cause of action.
Correct. And I can bring my defamation claim, and if I satisfy my defamation requirements, I get to go there. But South Dakota also allows product disparagement cases. The Paintbrush decision says very clearly that product disparagement is alive and well in South Dakota. There's been no indication, and there's never been a South Dakota case indicating that it doesn't exist in the common law or that it's a novel concept in the common law. Paintbrush simply says, plaintiff is asserting a product disparagement claim. Our elements we take from Restatement 623A, which was instituted in 1977, and then said that that's been met. So
obviously, in Paintbrush, they could not have had a claim under SDCL Chapter 20-10A because it's not an agricultural.
No, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. But the mere fact that I can assert a statutory cause of action, I mean, we can use Paintbrush as a good example. In Paintbrush, I asserted a statute. The plaintiff asserts a statutory cause of action for the defamation and a common law cause of action for product disparagement based on the same operative facts. We're doing the exact same thing. We're bringing statutory causes of action for defamation and for AFPDA violation, and we're bringing a common law claim under product disparagement. No court has ever said that you can't do that. You're absolutely right, Your Honor, that I can't get combined damages. I can't, you know, get double recovery by doing that. But I absolutely can always plead the alternative and get the jury charged on that. The other point, the point that I want to get back to with the remedy issue is and we cited these in our briefs for you, the Mansfield decision, the Overcast decision, and the Frontier decision all address the idea that when a statute is providing you cumulative and additional remedies, you're not expressing an intent to get rid of the common law remedy, that you shouldn't read that into it. And we are aware of no South Dakota decision that ever goes to the contrary on that.
So what is additional about the chapter except the provision for treble damages?
The additional cause of action that is provided is the treble damages. Is the treble damages. Which I understand you can contend for. I want to talk about pink slime last. The argument about pink slime is not only unprecedented under South Dakota law, it's unprecedented anywhere. The defendants used the description pink slime 132 times. This wasn't an off-the-cuff remark or a one-time incident. It was 132 different times. The defendants used pink slime in the course of a fact-laden, startling investigation by ABC News. This wasn't done as part of a union piece or political commentary or a food review case. And pink slime was used by the defendants to describe our product specifically. It wasn't a generic term. It's not like just saying traitor or blackmailer. This was describing our product specifically. And those three characteristics distinguish every other case you ever see where somebody says, that's rhetorical hyperbole. This court must determine whether or not pink slime, and it's the same for all opinion issues, the court's question is, could a reasonable juror conclude that ABC implied false facts by describing the product as pink slime 132 times? I suggest yes. First, you have to think about the context in which it's used. Because pink slime here isn't used in isolation. They call it pink slime, they call it a filler, they call it a substitute, they call it not meat, they call it not fresh ground beef, not what a typical person considers meat. In that context, pink slime is part of the way that ABC implied our product was not beef. At the same time they called it pink slime, they called the product an adulterant. They said that the trimmings are waste and scraps. They said that the trimmings come from the most contaminated parts of the cow. They say the trimmings were once used only for dog food and that we have to spray and disinfect the product. Using pink slime in that context is part of the way they implied our product was not safe. At the same time, they call our product pink slime, they called it gelatin, more like gelatin, looks like Play-Doh. That's part of the way pink slime in that context is implying our product is not nutritious. Then finally, of course, they call it pink slime, and they're implying that it's technically slime, and that is the reaction consumers had. Those are all facts, okay? The implying our product's not beef, implying our product's not safe, implying our product's not nutritious, implying our product is slime, those are all factual assertions. The use of pink slime is implying those false facts. But it's beyond just the context. It's the tone. The tone of the reports is critical. Because these reports are presented by ABC as being factual reports. They said that there was this start of an investigation that they were doing. They said that they held up their sources as being credible firsthand sources. They said that this was their investigative journalist team going out. The entire tone of the reports was a very serious news piece. They were conveying to consumers in this serious news piece facts. And when you call something and you describe a food product as pink slime 132 times in a fact-laden news piece, you are conveying facts. At the very least, that's a jury issue.
Stephen Sanford on behalf of defendant Kit Foshi.
Alex Hager on behalf of the Israel.
Ed Evans on behalf of Gerald Turnstein and Carl Custer.
Thank you, counsel. There are four motions pending before the court. The court has determined the amount of time that will be allotted to each side in arguing as to those motions. Mr. Tom Reynolds, the court's law clerk, will be keeping track of the time, and he will provide warnings when the time is about to expire, as well as when the time has expired. When the time does expire, if counsel is in the middle of a sentence or in a discussion with the court, counsel should ask permission of the court to please continue with their argument. The court will be taking a 15-minute recess after the first motion is heard, and then we will reconvene for the remaining three motions. The court, before turning to the argument of counsel, does want to address a procedural matter on the record, and that is that the court has before it motions to dismiss based on South Dakota Statute 15-6-12B5 and B2. The motions to dismiss under B5 are for a failure to state a claim. The motions under B2 are for lack of personal jurisdiction. The court would understand that under the failure to state a claim assertion under B5, that only if the court states to the parties that it intends to treat the motion as one for summary judgment will the court consider any matters outside the pleadings. The court does not intend to treat this as a motion for summary judgment. I am considering the 12B5 motion only as a motion to dismiss, and I will not be considering any matters outside the pleadings. That specifically means that I will not be considering any exhibits that are attached to what I will refer to generally as the ABC defendant's motions to dismiss. Those are exhibits A through H. Attached to the motion to dismiss all claims of BPI, nor will I be considering exhibits B through F attached to ABC motions to dismiss all claims of BPI tech and freezing machines. I'm making an exception only for exhibit A to that motion of ABC, which is the order granting the plaintiff's motion to remand the case from the South Dakota Federal District Court back to this court. That, I believe, is law of the case, and that is a decision and order that is appropriately considered. But otherwise, the court is not considering any other matter, and I am doing so because even though I recognize that the federal courts are willing to look beyond the pleadings and to allow the court to look beyond the pleadings for certain items, such as items that can be taken judicial notice of, the South Dakota Supreme Court has not been so willing. In the recent case of Guth Miller versus Deloitte and Touche, found in 2005 SD 77, in that case,
at the very least, a reasonable juror could conclude that the use of pink slime in that context, with that tone, was implying false facts about our product. And the consumer reactions validate that. The consumer actions actually show the consumers believed that the use of pink slime was implying that it wasn't beef, wasn't nutritious, wasn't safe, and that it was technically slime. With respect to the consumer comments, and I'll go very quickly on this, I know that ABC has suggested the court should not pay attention to those at all, which is ironic, because the consumer comments actually show that ABC knows their false statements are creating all these negative impressions, and then they kept repeating them. But there's none of the cases they cite is out of South Dakota. And I'm not aware of a South Dakota decision that says the court can't consider those contemporaneous comments. And I think the closest case on point to that is the Supreme Court's decision in Bago. I don't remember the last name of Bago. It's B-E-G-O. And in the fact pattern in Bago was a principal had walked into a teacher's classroom and said to the students, this teacher is only interested in collecting a paycheck. The issue went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court was trying to determine whether or not that was reasonably susceptible to a defamatory meaning. Part of the evidence that the court in Bago considered was testimony from two of the students in the room about their reaction to those statements. And so I think Bago suggests this court can take that into consideration. The cases that ABC cited, those are parody cases. Those are satire cases. That's evaluated completely differently under the law. And no one here is pretending that what ABC did was a parody or a satire piece. You know, in those cases, the plaintiff was trying to say this parody piece was considered to be implying actual facts. And the court said, no, this is clearly a parody piece. You know, one of them was actually labeled the April Fool's Day edition of the newsletter. So those have no application.
Mr. Conley, the Bagel case, was that on summary judgment?
Yes.
Thank you.
I think I'm right on that. I apologize if I'm wrong.
Mr. Bailey.
Thank you. Do I have 10 minutes?
Thank you.
Counsel suggested that there was no South Dakota case granting a motion to dismiss in a libel case, so I would cite the court to the Supreme Court of South Dakota's opinion in Furr, F-U-R-R, versus Folk, F-O-U-L-K-E, at 62 South Dakota 15, 250 Northwest 667, in which the Supreme Court reversed the failure to sustain a demur, explaining that the court's duty was to determine in the first instance whether the meaning ascribed by the pleader is the natural and probable one. And the court concluded that the meaning ascribed by the pleader in that case was not the natural and probable one, and therefore said the demurrer should have been sustained.
And when the year of that case, did you know?
1933. And when the court makes this decision, it should not make any reference to the reader comments for two reasons. One is they are legally irrelevant. I mentioned before that there was a dual role. The court has a role, and the trier of fact has the role. The court's role is a purely legal one to ask whether or not it's reasonable to conclude that ABC intended to convey these meanings, or in the words of the Supreme Court of South Dakota, whether the meaning alleged is the natural and probable one. That's to be determined by the court as a matter of law. No court, to our knowledge, anywhere has ever looked to reader or viewer comments for assistance in deciding that legal issue. And it would be improper legally. It would also be very difficult to sort through. Your Honor, there were 1,139 viewer comments attached to the plaintiff's complaint. They claim that 189, about 15%, concluded that LFTB is not safe. That is just not so. Most of those 169 comments don't address safety at all. The prevailing comment is pink slime is disgusting. Some people say things like, no wonder there's so much cancer in the world. ABC didn't talk about cancer. You can't rely upon viewer comments to inform the court's judgment on what a reasonable, natural, and probable interpretation of these broadcasts is. On preemption, Your Honor, the statute did not address all of the conceivable product disparagement claims that might be brought, and so we don't claim preemption of all product disparagement. The statute zeroed in on one kind of product disparagement claim and answered every question that could be asked about that kind of claim. And so the displacement or preemption is narrow in its scope, but it is complete within that scope. You have heard no argument from the plaintiff that there was any issue that could possibly be raised in an agricultural food product disparagement case that is not addressed by that statute. It is comprehensive as to this kind of claim, and there's been no argument up to the contrary.
Except, I believe, from your prior argument that if they assert that it's not nutritious or not, if it doesn't go to safety, the statute doesn't speak to that, does it?
It does in this sense. A claim that you have disparaged my product because you have suggested it is not nutritious is a claim of disparagement. And the statute defines what disparagement means in South Dakota. It defines disparagement as a statement about safety made with knowledge of falsity. And I think you have to conclude that this legislature knew what it was doing when it was defining disparagement. You know, counsel says they didn't say they were preempting, but the law is that if you've covered the whole subject and done it in a way that's inconsistent with otherwise applicable standards, you have preempted. And if you don't want to, then you make a statement that you don't want to preempt. So, for example, South Dakota has adopted the Uniform Securities Act, and you can bring a claim of common law fraud and state securities fraud in the state of South Dakota. And you can do so because the legislature said explicitly the rights and remedies provided by this chapter are in addition to any other rights or remedies that may exist. That's SDCL 4731B 509M. That wasn't done here. The legislature adopted a comprehensive scheme that answered all of the questions. And you have heard no response whatsoever from the plaintiff to my point that there is utter inconsistency between the definition of disparagement under the statute and the common law, and between the standard of proof, the standard of recovery, knowledge of falsity versus reckless disregard.
And so the South Dakota legislature intentionally narrowed the definition of disparagement as regards to a producer of a perishable agricultural food product.
Yes, most certainly did. There can be no question about that. And it made a conscious decision, and surely it wasn't a mistaken decision, to only allow recovery for the most serious type of claim you could possibly make about an agricultural food product that's not safe to eat. You can only recover for that most damaging kind of statement, if you can prove knowledge of falsity, it would be utterly inconsistent and it would make no sense whatsoever to say that you must prove knowledge of falsity if you claim that something is unsafe to eat. If you're going to make a less serious claim that it's less nutritious, oh, then you can recover on a much less severe standard than knowledge of falsity. You can recover for a less serious statement about relative nutritional value on the basis of a lesser showing of fault. That makes no sense. What the legislature did makes sense. They took the most serious kind of claim. They said you can recover for it, but only upon a showing of knowledge of falsity. And I said the other things don't constitute disparagement in the state of South Dakota. So producers, citizens, everyone can talk freely about relative quality, relative nutrition, and not worry about being sued for product disparagement. If I may, Your Honor, a couple of quick words about safety. PPC did not present two sides of a safety story. There's only one side to that truck. There's only one side to the story that was told about safety every time the issue of safety was explicitly addressed. ABC was very careful in every single broadcast to say it's safe to eat. And they didn't say, but critics contend it's unsafe. They say, but critics contend it's not as nutritious. I don't know how they could be any more clear than that. And it's very important at this stage of the proceeding that we somehow get clarity on what this case is going to be all about. And quite frankly, we should not have to go through discovery and the uncertainty of being subjected to a jury verdict on the basis of some inference about safety when ABC went to such pains to underscore the point that they were not making any kind of a criticism about safety.
What about the assertion that the court needs to look at the comments in the totality? That the court shouldn't just take out isolated comments either on the plaintiff's side where they want to say it's false or on the other side when they want to say it's not false and it'd be a whole picture.
Well,
shouldn't I look at the entirety?
Yes, you should, Your Honor, but here again I have to express a word of caution. Even today in the argument, we have words taken from one broadcast spliced together with words taken from another broadcast and mushed together. So when we saw this, the USDA statement about safety, counsel said, oh, but ABC said that the USDA person had some ties to the industry. Well, on March 15th, when ABC put on the screen that the USDA says it's safe, there was no discussion in the March 15th broadcast about any reason why the USDA's decision was suspect whatsoever. And so you do have to kind of look at what's being said close in proximity to each other. But when the most they can come up with are words strung together from different broadcasts weeks apart to create some impression that maybe there's a safety issue, I would say none of that amounts to a hill of beans when placed against the explicit statements, unqualified, that it's safe to eat. It can be difficult to put together a broadcast. E.B. White, the great writer of style, said, there's nothing I ever wrote that I couldn't have written better. And I'm sure I could look at the briefs that I wrote and I could improve them now, and I could look at ABC scripts and I could improve them to make them even more clear than they are. But I don't think a journalist or a news organization should be subjected to a lengthy litigation about a claim of safety when they went to such pains to underscore that this product was perfectly safe. Your Honor, counsel makes a comment about the disinformation campaign and the repetition. I will only say this. Repetition doesn't equal defamation, and repetition in a complaint does not equal a cause of action. Yes, ABC covered this story on an ongoing basis. But they did it because there were developments, and every story was tied to a new development. And when you tell the story based upon the new development, some repetition of the old material is necessary to address the viewers who might not have seen the earlier material. So yes, there's repetition, but that doesn't make a cause of action. There's nothing here outside the bounds of normal journalism. ABC did research, it interviewed people, and it put together broadcasts. This is not tortious interference with contract. This is normal journalistic activity. And for a tortious interference claim, you have to have improper activity, and there's nothing improper in that sense in what ABC did. This was not a competitor trying to lure business away. It was a news organization putting on a broadcast. And if this is tortious interference, then Consumer Reports must be guilty of tortious interference every time they do a consumer report that urges people to buy this product or not. Or defamation, but never for tortious interference. I have nothing further, Your Honor. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you. We'll be in recess for 15 minutes. The court had taken judicial notice of the fact that the defendants were accountants. And the South Dakota Supreme Court said that was inappropriate for the trial court to do. And so I take that directive from the South Dakota Supreme Court that they are much more hesitant than the federal courts in allowing such matters to be considered. And so as to the 12B5 motion, I will not be considering any matters outside of pleadings. Now, I do want to make a distinction between the 12B2 motion for lack of personal jurisdiction. That the Supreme Court of South Dakota appears to follow federal law and allow matters to be considered, specifically documentary evidence, including affidavits and declarations. In the Marsh case, found at 2007 SD 125, the Supreme Court specifically did discuss and allow such documentary evidence. So as to the motion to dismiss filed by Zernstein and Custer, I will allow reference to documents outside the pleadings. So with that, the court is going to proceed first with the motion to dismiss that has been filed by ABC defendants as to all claims of BPI. And so first I would hear from counsel for the ABC defendants as to that motion.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Kevin Bain. I represent the ABC defendants. May I reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal? So I divide my time 30 to 10?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Your Honor, my goal this afternoon is to try to simplify this case and to clarify what's really at issue. We have a 250-page complaint with 27 counts, but there are not 27 separate claims and there are not 27 separate issues on this motion. There are really three or four principal issues on the motion. There are nine separate counts attacking specific words and phrases, and each of those counts is repeated twice. But when you get right down to asking why the plaintiff is complaining about those words, it all comes back to three meanings. The plaintiffs allege that the ABC defendants and the individual defendants disparage their product in three ways: by indicating that it's not safe to eat, by indicating that it's not nutritious, and by indicating that it's not meat at all. As I said, when you examine all of the individual words and phrases, the only reason that anyone's complaining about those, I believe, is because of the argument that they imply one of these three allegedly defamatory meanings. Now, if the reports don't imply any of those three things, Then the question is, what is the relevance of the attack upon the words? And our position is, if the words don't convey any of those three meanings, then the quarrel over those words is really a quarrel over editorial judgment. And that's the first point that I want to underscore this afternoon, Your Honor. The plaintiffs in this case don't get to choose ABC's words, or the words of Mr. Zernstein, or the words of Mr. Custer, or the words of Mr. Fauci. What the plaintiffs can do is complain that the defendants conveyed a disparaging or defamatory meaning. But if the words don't convey one of those meanings, then it's just a quarrel over words. And so the principal question before the court today, and the first question I will address, is whether these reports convey either of these three meanings. The other principal question that I will also address is whether ABC and the other defendants had the right to use the term pink slime. These are not questions of fact for the jury, Your Honor. They are legal questions for the court.
And I would agree with dismiss. It's not at a motion for summary judgment stage, and so why should the court at this stage take on the issue?
Fair question, Your Honor. The court has a very important gatekeeping function to play in a case of this kind. It's different from the function that the court plays in a motion to dismiss in another kind of case. The gatekeeping function is one that can be performed at the outset because the court has before it everything that it needs to look at to answer the questions that we're posing. It has the reports themselves. This is a function that is routinely performed on a motion to dismiss because the law says it's a legal function for the court. It's not for the trier of fact, so it's not really even a summary judgment issue where you examine whether there are issues of fact. It is a function that needs to be performed at this stage on the motion to dismiss, quite frankly, in order to protect First Amendment rights. More is at stake here than the mere expense of litigation. What is at stake is the freedom of a news organization and individual citizens to report on matters of public interest without the fear of being subjected to the uncertainty and the burdens and the risks of litigation of this kind.
Is this part of your argument that basically a news organization should be immune from liability for defamation, which is how the plaintiffs characterize your argument?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. I think my argument is best summarized in Section 614 of the Restatement of Torts, which makes very clear that there are two entirely separate functions in a libel case. The court has a function, and the trier of fact has a function. The court's function is to decide whether the challenged publication or broadcast can reasonably be understood to convey a false and defamatory meaning. Now, if the court decides as a threshold matter on the motion to dismiss that the report can reasonably be understood to convey one of these three meanings I talked about, then, and only then, is it for the trier of fact to determine whether the reports in fact were understood to convey those meanings. But the restatement section 614 is very clear in separating the role of the court and the role of the jury. So the question for the court is whether these reports can reasonably be understood to convey these defamatory meanings. And section 563 of the restatement defines what the meaning of a publication is. And the meaning of the publication is the meaning that the recipient, the viewer, the reader, reasonably understands that it was intended to express. It's not the judgments or the conclusions that the reader or the viewer reaches on his or her own. It's what the recipient reasonably understands that it was intended to express. So what the court does on a motion like this is first ask exactly what is the false and defamatory meaning that is being alleged, and second, ask whether the broadcasts can reasonably be understood to have been intended to convey that meaning. So the first meaning that the plaintiffs allege, and to us the most significant one, is that these reports imply that this product is unsafe to eat. And of course, the Agricultural Food Product Disparagement Act creates a claim of that kind. The plaintiff treats this as a tag-along claim by putting it toward the end of their complaint. But we quite frankly think it's the key to the case. I'll tell you why. The Act defines disparagement in these terms. It says disparagement is the dissemination in any manner to the public of any information that the disseminator knows to be false and that states or implies that an agricultural food product is not safe for consumption by the public. So the question for the court is whether or not these reports can reasonably be understood to have been intended to convey the message that lean, finely textured beef is not safe for consumption. And I would maintain that they can only be understood that way if you ignore what ABC actually said.
And before you get to that, I do want to address with you briefly the assertion that the defendants have made that South Dakota Chapter 20-10A is the exclusive manner in which the plaintiffs can assert any claim for disparagement. And first of all, my question is it my understanding that your position is that the common law disparagement claim is displaced by that statutory provision?
That is correct.
What about defamation?
Two parts to that answer. to the extent that the claims that are identified in the complaint as defamation are really product disparagement claims, they should fall as well. The law draws a very careful distinction between defamation and product disparagement. If a publication merely attacks the quality of a product, or the nutritional value, or the safety, if it attacks the product, it's disparagement. The restatement again says, in order for it to be defamation, something more must be alleged. There must be a claim of dishonesty or improper conduct of some sort. And we would acknowledge that two of the defamation claims fall into that category, but that seven of them are merely restatements of the food disparagement claims, and that they should fall as well if the court agrees with us that the statute displaces the common law of product disparagement.
And in keeping with that argument, the issue, when I look at South Dakota Chapter 20-10A, it says that the person who has a cause of action under that chapter is a producer.
Yes.
And so ABC defendants' argument, as I understood it, is that some of the plaintiffs are not producers. So if they're not producers, if the court would agree with you that they're not producers, then could they assert a claim for common law disparagement?
I would say, Your Honor, that the law is rather clear in every jurisdiction. There is no case law, no precedent that supports the proposition that someone who neither produces, owns, nor sells the product can bring a common law claim for product disparagement.
But you just made an interesting statement. If they have some ownership interest in the product or have some role in producing it, aren't they then able to bring a claim for disparagement?
Your Honor, this is what I intend to spend most of my second half hour on the BPI Tech motion going through with Your Honor, explaining why they don't have a claim.
We will address it then, so please continue.
Thank you. So let me talk a little bit about this safety issue, because it's important for a number of reasons to discuss this in some detail. Every single broadcast that is a challenge at this, in this case contains an explicit assurance that this product is safe to eat. The first broadcast on March 7th said that the product is treated with ammonia to make it safe to eat. In the second broadcast, on March 8th, the next day, ABC not only said that the USDA says it's safe to eat, it emphasized the point in its animation. Let me show that to the court on that. This is, and the plaintiff's counsel may have some trouble seeing this, so I have copies of these demonstrators that I'll give to counsel to make it easier for them. I also have a set for the court if I may approach.
Yes. And again, you're using these for demonstrative purposes only?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. These are part of the record because they're screenshots from the broadcast which are an exhibit to the complaint. So what we have before us is actually attached to the plaintiff's complaint is their Exhibit 3, Exhibit B to Exhibit 3, and these are screenshots from the animation that appeared in the first and second broadcasts, starting with the cow and showing the meat trimmings being tempered and centrifuged and treated with anhydrous ammonia and then frozen in blocks. And so this animation proceeds on screen, and these are the screenshots that the plaintiff has taken from the actual video and plays as an exhibit to the complaint. But this animation continues beyond what the plaintiffs have shown you in their physical exhibits. And the actual video, which is also an exhibit, shows that on the second day that ABC ran this animation, the animation concluded with this picture on screen. Again, this is not part of the plaintiff's physical exhibits, but it's part of the video, so it is in the record. And this is an illustration of what the video shows. At the end of this animation, it shows a truck with the word safe to eat in big bold letters on the side of the truck. Again, you don't see this from the exhibits to the complaint that are in paper form, but it's on the video. I can't think of a more graphic demonstration and emphasis of the point, this product is safe to eat, than a screenshot like that. And it continues with every subsequent broadcast. On March 9th, ABC said the government says the filler is safe on March 13th. Bottom line, FDA says it's safe. March 15th, the USDA is clear in saying pink slime is safe. And again, another screenshot that's on the exhibits in the record. On screen, it says USDA pink slime is safe. On March 21st, ABC quoted a statement by Safeway, again emphasizing that this product is safe, and the screenshot highlighted the message. Screenshot says the USDA and food industry executives agree, so it's not just EPI, the USDA, the government, and the industry agree that lean, finely textured beef is safe. That's Good Morning America in the morning. And then World News at night, again, highlights on the screen the same message, that the government and the food industry agree that this product is safe. It continues after that on March 21st. It says the same thing on March 26th.
Mr. Bain, I'm going to stop you because I have a question. As I would understand, most news organizations, when they present a story, will, in my words, try to present both sides. So what you're showing me now is what I would characterize as the effort to show one side of the story. But they were also telling the other side of the story, which are the assertions that it was not safe, or at least questioning whether it was safe. And so why would it be that simply by stating the alternative argument, would that make somebody immune from liability?
This is a very important point, Your Honor. Nowhere in any broadcast or in any online report did ABC ever say itself or quote anybody else or refer to anybody else suggesting in any way that the product is unsafe. Now, we're going to talk later on about the meanings of whether it's nutritious and whether it's beef, but on the safety point, these statements that I'm showing you were never qualified with any but. Once, on March 20, I forget the date, I apologize. March 21st, there was a but. Here's what it said. Online report on March 21st, Exhibit 19. Makers of lean, finely textured beef and the USDA say that it is not an additive, need not be labeled, and is safe to eat. But critics contend it is less nutritious than pure ground beef. So the but is not that it's unsafe. The but is, well, the critic's point is that it's less nutritious. And so, and Your Honor, this is confusing because, quite frankly, the plaintiffs have not only completely ignored all of the assertions of safety and the video illustrations that it's safe to eat. But then they have done something else. They have wrenched words out of context and spliced them together to create whole new phrases and meanings that ABC never said. For example, ABC never said that the trimmings were exposed to fecal matter, a charge that BPI repeats 7 times in its brief. They never said that. They said the hide is exposed to fecal matter, which is conceitedly true. ABC never called LFTB contaminated waste, a term that BPI uses in its brief 7 times. Once, they referred to this product as being made from waste trimmings, which is pretty much what BPI has said, that they recover lean meat from trimmings that would otherwise be waste. But the word contaminated or contaminant, the concept, didn't even appear in that entire broadcast that used the word waste. Yet BPI tells you in their briefs 7 times that ABC called this contaminated waste. It did not. ABC never stated, as they claim in their briefs, that the product is an adulterant, i.e. a poisonous substance. One broadcast, one online report, referred to this as an adulterant. March 27th, and Mr. Zernstein called it an adulterant, and ABC explained why. Because it fixes the color of the meat. So he regarded it as an adulterant. He didn't say it was because because it was a poison. In fact, he said it gets rid of pathogens. And the report goes on to say that this product is safe. So it is a complete distortion of Mr. Zernstein's words to say that he called it an adulterant, i.e. a poisonous substance. He said it's an adulterant because it fixes the color. And so I think it's a really important point, and Your Honor raised a very important question. If ABC had said, well, one person says it's safe and one person says it's not safe, we would have a very interesting and different argument. I would still maintain the question would be whether the reasonable viewer would conclude that ABC intended to convey the message that it was safe rather than conveying the message that there is a debate. So even if ABC had done what Your Honor posited, there would still be the question of whether it would be fair to conclude that ABC intended to endorse one of the two meanings it presented. But the point here is that ABC never hinted that this is unsafe. They never quoted critics as saying it's unsafe. And so there is absolutely zero support for the proposition that ABC intended to say that this is unsafe. And I defy anyone to come up with any libel or disparagement case in the history of litigation in which a report illustrated the point of safety so many times in an unqualified fashion and was found somehow responsible legally on a motion to dismiss stage for having reasonably conveyed a meaning that's the exact opposite of what they said. If this isn't clear enough, then I don't see how a news organization could ever protect itself from litigation.
Well, one of the cases in South Dakota that the court has been looking at, because it was at a similar stage, is the Janklow versus Viking Press case, in which former Governor Janklow sued Viking Press and others for defamation for allegations that had been made against him regarding rape charges or assertions that have been made. And I don't recall the specific discussion in the case, but I believe that there was likely a reference in the documentation that Mr. Janklow denied those allegations, and that the charges were either dismissed or not commenced or otherwise resolved in his favor. So this seems to be a similar analogy to that circumstance. And in that case, the South Dakota Supreme Court said it would survive a motion to dismiss. So how is it different from the Janklow case?
There are all of these cases turn on the very specific words that are used in the broadcast. And there are many cases in which motions to dismiss are granted and many in which they're denied. I can think of no case in which a broadcast or news organization was held potentially responsible for a meaning that is the exact opposite of what it said. There are times when broadcasts and publications are ambiguous and it's unclear, and it can reasonably be understood either way. And if what I've presented here and if what ABC presented can reasonably be understood in a way to suggest that this is unsafe, then the court should deny the motion. But there is a legal standard, and then there are words and video that the court has to look at. And you compare what ABC said to the standard. And with respect, I don't think on these facts, which are before the court through the complaint and through the broadcast themselves, that anybody could reasonably conclude that ABC intended to say the opposite of what it put on the screen and what it said repeatedly in every single broadcast, never with a word of qualification. And I do want to discuss preemption, because I think it's clear they have not stated a claim under the statute. And the question then is, BPI cannot meet the statutory definition of disparagement. Can it invoke some broader notion of disparagement under the common law? The answer is no, for two reasons, because there are two ways in which the court addresses these kinds of questions. The first is, they ask whether the statute covers the whole subject of damages for the type of claim created. In this case, of course, recovery of damages for agricultural food product disparagement. And it's very clear the statute covers the whole subject matter. It answers every question that could possibly be asked about that kind of a claim.
Except who is a producer?
Well, you have to, the court has to define that. But it tells you that only the producer can bring it. There are words that need to be interpreted, to be sure, and we'll discuss that on the next motion. But it says only who can sue, the producer, what they can sue for, disparagement, what constitutes disparagement, what the definition is. It's not left to the courts to evolve. It's defined. What you have to prove, knowledge of falsity, what kind of damages you can recover, actual and treble, what kind of extra proof you have to have for treble damages, intent to injure, when you have to sue, statutes of limitations. BPI argued in its papers that the statute does not cover the whole subject area because it only covers treble damages. If that were true, then I would have no argument. If it only created a treble damage remedy, then it obviously would not displace the common law remedy for actual damages. But with respect, they have misread the statute. The statute explicitly covers both actual damages and treble damages. It covers all of the territory that the common law covers insofar as disparagement of an agricultural food product is concerned. The second question the courts ask is, well, is there inconsistency between the common law and the statute? And the answer here is there is inconsistency in two very important respects. First, the common law would change the definition of disparagement to include statements less disparaging than statements about safety. And secondly, it would set a lower standard of proof. The statute says the plaintiff must prove knowledge of falsity. The common law would say you only have to prove reckless disregard for the truth. Think about this. Count 26 alleges a claim under the statute. Count 24 alleges the exact same safety claim under the common law. Under count 26, the plaintiff would have to prove knowledge of falsity. Under count 24, we'd only have to prove reckless disregard for the truth. That's inconsistent. It's one or the other. It can't be both. There can't be two standards of recovery for the exact same claim. The statute is completely inconsistent with the common law in the standard of recovery and in the definition of disparagement.
So now, I go back to how you broke out the claims here, not safe, not nutritious, not beef. The South Dakota statute, you talk about the not safe part. Are you then contending that they cannot bring a claim for disparagement by asserting it's not nutritious or not beef because of the preemption?
Yes, Your Honor, because the statute defines disparagement. At common law, there was a notion of disparagement. And the statute comes along and says, we're going to create a claim for agricultural food product disparagement. And they define the word disparagement to mean a statement that it suggests that it's not safe. So, yes, the answer is that's also displaced by the statute. Now, clearly the legal tests for preemption or displacement are met. But you might ask, well, does this make any sense? And I would suggest that it does make sense. What the legislature did is it created an actual damages remedy for the most serious kind of charge you can make about an agricultural food product that is not safe to eat. And it left the less serious charges about, say, the quality of the product or relative nutritional value, it left those things to be resolved through free discussion and the free economic market. And it's not just journalists who have an interest in participating in this discussion about the value of food. Food producers themselves have an interest in being able to speak freely about the relative merits and superiority of their product over someone else's. This protects the ability of a producer to say, my corn is better than theirs. Our grain-fed beef is better than the imported grass-fed beef. Our honey is more pure than theirs. It enables BPI to say, our lean, finely textured beef is better than Cargill's. So they, too, get some protection from the statute. But whether or not you think it makes sense, Your Honor, it is crystal clear. The statute defined a cause of action for disparagement, and it limited it to statements about safety, and it required that knowledge of falsity be proven. If I may ask for clarification, I think I was told I had a minute left and 5 minutes left in my 30 minutes. Thank you. Okay, then I do want to address the pink slime issue, if I might, Your Honor, because that's kind of a separate kind of issue. Our position, quite simply, is that the term pink slime is not actionable because it's a rhetorical expression that doesn't say anything that is objectively false. Yes, it is unflattering, even critical. After all, it was coined by a critic. Was Mr. Zernstein, who disapproved of this product, prohibited from calling it pink slime? Was ABC prohibited from repeating this term, which was out there? National and local news organizations had used it before. NBC, CBS, New York Times, the Argus Leader had been used many, many times. Make no mistake about it, Your Honor, we're talking about free speech here. If the First Amendment means anything, it means that supporters and critics alike must be able to coin their own flattering and pejorative terms to talk about a product like this. Pink slime is rhetorical, it's hyperbolic, it reflects a subjective judgment, it's not a statement of fact at all. But if it is, it's not untrue. It's pink, and it's slimy.